You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. And with me today for the second of a two-part interview is futurist Bob Johansson. Bob is the author of more than 10 books covering various aspects of how we can go about understanding the future and being ready for it. And in this episode, we'll have a chance to talk with Bob about some of the really big issues that we need to begin thinking about, including things like ambient health. If you don't know what that is, just stick around. You're going to hear more about that. We're also going to talk about how we can manage dilemmas, which are key to solving some of the big problems that we have before us. And also tracking signals, which is something that all of us can do to really ready our inner futurists. So, Bob, welcome back for the second edition.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Art.
So one of the things we're taught as futurists is to pay attention to signals. And I've actually created a social media page on Facebook.
Nice.
A group called Signals, and there are about 500 of us who just sort of curate things that we see in the world that are weird, maybe out on the fringes right now, but if they could be scaled, would have significant impact. But tell us about what people can do with these signals and how can that be the basis of a forecast?
So the William Gibson quote that I mentioned earlier, the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. A signal for us is an example of that unevenly distributed future that just kind of provokes thought. And it can be the beginning of a story. So let me give an example. Just a couple of weeks ago, Jeff Bezos issued a letter to shareholders where he talked about a new algorithm that Amazon is introducing to track workers in the warehouses and distribution centers, to track workers' bodies in terms of muscular structural disorders and help people understand when they've been lifting too much with a particular muscle set that they're about to be injured, to kind of warn them in advance and shift it to another kind of labor to avoid bodily harm. Now, that's a signal, but it's a very interesting, provocative signal. So what I've learned over the years is when I see a signal that's a really good one like this, I get a kind of queasy feeling in my stomach because I say, whoa, that's really interesting. And usually the first reaction is different from the reaction as I think it through. So the first reaction here, link that back to what I said earlier about sensors everywhere and some of them in our bodies. It's going to be great if we've got the ability to sense an injury before it happens. You know, that's really a good thing. On the other hand, I'm not sure I want Jeff Bezos tracking my body parts. That's weird. And that requires trust. Right. And most of us don't have that kind of trust in Jeff Bezos. So it's a dilemma. It's not a problem that can be solved. But signals are like that. They're provocative in an interesting way. And sometimes they're just kind of weird. And the other thing about signals, most signals fail, but they fail in an interesting way. So this one, I think, is going to fail. It probably will fail because of privacy reasons. But even if it fails, it's going to fail in an interesting way. So what if that was a body sensor that you could have an app for on your smartphone? And what if that body sensor told you, you've been lifting a lot on your left arm for all morning. You better switch to your right arm. by this afternoon. You know, what if it did that, but the higher ground was choice and it wasn't Jeff Bezos telling you to do it? It was you making the choice. You know, that's a different game. That's a different kind of body sensor. So that's an example of a signal and an example of a story that comes out of it. And a forecast, after all, it's not a prediction. It's a story from the future designed to provoke insight in the present. So in this case, the big story is sensors everywhere, some in our body. The signals is the algorithm that Amazon's experimenting with to anticipate muscular structural disorders. And the insight is, aha, there'll be a new ability there, but we got to be careful of this issue of privacy and of security and of trust. And how do we make good decisions there that keep it on the higher ground?
Well, it's so interesting because it looks like two of the three big areas that you're focusing on now can also cause these things that you call dilemmas, right? I mean, if
exactly
we can create a great technology, but we need to be focused on security and privacy and so forth.
That's right. A dilemma is a problem that can't be solved, but it can be improved. But the beginning is to realize it's a dilemma. There's plenty of problems you can solve, but those are the easy things, you know, things you can solve. The big issues, like the one we're talking about, the issues where future back thinking comes in very handy, those are more likely to be dilemmas, problems you can't solve. And for senior leaders, we deal the rest of our lives with dilemmas. So we don't get to solve problems anymore. There's plenty of problems to solve, but kind of farm those out and get them solved. But focus on the dilemmas. That's where the big impact opportunities exist.
Bob, if I were to ask you about two or three shifts, aside from these big audacious ones that you've talked about, what are you seeing that we as everyday people living our lives might want to begin paying some attention to, especially those of us who are in the business or who are in the act or service of giving back to society?
Yeah. So the area we've started to talk about, the thread about sensors and about health and health choices, the bigger issue around this is what you might think of as ambient health and the need for health in the post-outbreak world. And what we're moving into, I can say now with some clarity, thinking 10 years out, we're over that next decade, we're going to face the rolling risk of big health and climate disruptions at the intersection of animal, human health, and land use. That's where the novel coronavirus came from. It's because of that intersection. It's not isolated. It's linked very directly to climate disruption. So it's obvious that we're going to have issues like that over the next decade. So there's a place where you can invest and have a very big impact, because that's where the biggest challenges are going to be faced. Now, you need to drill down then and say, okay, specifically, what are the areas where I think I can have an impact? And I'll tell a quick story. Just a couple months ago, I got a call from a futurist in Germany. And this person is a medical doctor working now for the Ministry of Health in Germany, and doing a case study of China about the use of artificial intelligence and machine learning to predict and diagnose health conditions and then to create treatments. And China is way ahead of the rest of the world in terms of the ability to diagnose and to treat using artificial intelligence algorithms. And they have digital twins now for many of their more wealthy people in the country, and it's now extending more widely. And a digital twin is basically a digital model of a person's body. So once you have a digital twin, you can do a much better job of anticipating what's going on. And this gets back to the Amazon story, but it's more powerful. It's really looking at diagnosing a health problem and then recommending a treatment and then following the treatment. Now, there's just one little problem. The state owns the data. So it's an authoritarian country, you know, so there isn't really the issue of who owns the data. The state owns the data. And it's a choice that maybe probably not a choice. It's a reality of the way that government is structured. Now, my friend back in Germany is intrigued by the model of how the Chinese are way ahead of us in terms of diagnostics and in terms of treatment. And now during COVID, they're way ahead of us in terms of telehealth. So the opportunity for doing much better health and health care is there in China in a way that it's not. My friend in Germany says, I can't even open the conversation about how the Chinese do this because of privacy. And in Germany, they're completely invested in the notion of an individual owning his or her own data, and they can't even have the conversation. Now, that's kind of sad to me, because shouldn't we at least be able to have the conversation? And how might we learn from the Chinese model, honor the German model about privacy of data? But it may well be that there's going to have to be some trade-offs there. So again, thinking foresight, inside action, and maybe bringing in this notion, well, the higher ground is choice. So what if you are willing to give away your own data? We're already doing that to some extent in the United States, even though we're not there yet in terms of patients owning their own data. That's still a battle that's being fought. But is that the right battle? Or is the larger public health question, what do we choose to do together? And how can you anonymize the data? And of course, that requires trust. But aren't you willing to give away some of your data in the interest of public health? I would be. But you got to trust whoever you're giving that data to. So that's an example of ambient health, let's call it. And 10 years out, it's obvious there's going to be dramatic potential for improving public health and individual health. But how do we get there? Who are the organizations pursuing that? And how are they doing that? And to get back to reciprocity advantage, it's amazing how much reciprocity advantage was revealed in the effort to develop the vaccine for COVID-19. And that, I think, ended up changing the way innovation is done in pharma. And it ends up changing the reputation of big pharma, but we don't know quite how yet. So, but that's an example, Art, of a space that's very powerful for charities and for investments. And wow, if you can invest in that space, you're going to change the world. But it's a dilemma. It's not a problem you can solve. And if you look at the Gates Foundation, that's a model for how they've perceived it. You know, they focused, first of all, on the solvable problems. And now they've kind of scaled up to the dilemmas around climate disruption. But again, at that intersection of animal, human health, and land use, that's the intersection. That's where the challenge is. And it's not going to go away for the rest of our lifetime. It's going to be a continuing dilemma. But there's all kinds of opportunities to have a positive impact in that space.
Well, I can't help but ask you also about something you bring up. I believe in Full Spectrum Thinking, your book, your newest book, I believe.
Yeah.
Which is this idea that maybe autocratic ways of doing things isn't scalable in the future. Would you talk about that and give us your sense of what you see there?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I'll give you my opinion, but it definitely is an opinion. There's different views about this. The driving force here is anything that can be distributed will be distributed. So that's the overall forecast. And I believe deeply in that. And the technology will amplify it. So the next generation of the internet, the next generation of packet switching is basically creating organizations with no center. They grow from the edges. They can't be controlled, but they can be guided. And technologies like blockchain, distributed authority computing, which I talk a lot about in the new book, that kind of computing is moving from the old-fashioned binary computing, which everything has to be boiled down to a zero or a one, to the next generation of full-spectrum computing, which is really moving toward distributed authority computing. So that's the infrastructure, the big driver. Now, the reason I'm more optimistic in the sense that I don't think authoritarian governments scale in this world. In a world where anything that can be distributed will be distributed, control economies won't work because you can't control them. They'll work in the short run because people are so confused. So that's why you see populist politicians and populist religions be popular for brief periods of time. But I don't believe they're going to be scalable over the long term. So I'm not as worried about authoritarianism. I'm not as worried about fascism. I am worried about we lose the ability to govern ourselves, that we go all the way in the other direction. I am really worried about that. But I've talked to you about this before. You know, I teach at the Army War College and I get the new 3-star generals on their first week in Washington. And the last time I did it in person, Madeleine Albright was following me. That was very imposing to begin with. But she was talking about her book called Fascism, A Warning. And she grew up in Eastern Europe and kind of faced fascism. I have great admiration for her. It's a very powerful book. I'm just not as worried about it as she is because I'm more deeply digital than she is. And I'm seeing this world of anything that can be distributed will be distributed. And I think that counters this kind of urge toward fascism, this urge toward authoritarianism. So I'm not saying they're going to go away. I'm just saying they're not going to scale in that way because of the anything that can be distributed will be distributed. But I am concerned that we lose the ability to govern, that you have these kind of simplistic politicians or simplistic religious leaders that are so critical of structures and of government in particular, that we lose that ability to govern. We lose that ability to choose what we do together.
And we have a signal of that.
Maybe we do.
That happened most recently, right, at the Capitol, where people who you might describe as activists, anarchists, or whatever you might want to say, simply went after the capital of our nation. And you're right, it's never clear what they're actually wanting. And so if we go too far in that direction, it can certainly be a problem because it'll be hard to get consensus about where we do go together, you know. And I think that's one of the real, as you say, dilemmas.
Yeah, that's really the dilemma. And you know, simple is good. Simplistic is bad. Yeah. Simple is attractive. Simplistic is dangerous. So there aren't any simple answers. And yet our brains want simple answers. That goes back to what I said right at the start. Our brains want certainty, but we can't have it. Now, there's always going to be some politician or some religious leader who will promise the simple, even if there isn't any simple. We just have to be careful of that. And again, I don't talk about politics. I'm focused 10 years ahead. But I can't help but notice in today's political environment that you see a lot of certainty on the part of politicians, but not much clarity. And yeah. And that's really dangerous. You want clarity, but you can't have certainty.
Bob, so one of the big, I think, changes that we have gone through as a result of the COVID pandemic has been a shift to virtual experiences, right? I mean, we have this thing called Zoom now, and we're all, you know, huddled together on these various platforms when we want to meet because we can't do it in person. But we saw this coming some time ago. And like many things in the future, I guess you would agree that it only takes one event to take something that's already there to scale. And maybe yeah. The pandemic was that. But what do you see in the future as it relates to these kinds of interactions and experiences? I know that you talk a lot about the importance of leaders being able to communicate via different mediums in your book that you put out called Leadership Literacies, New Leadership Literacies, being able to be there when you're not there. We've all had to learn to be there on Zoom when we're not there. What do you see in the future? Is this here to stay?
It is in various forms. And a couple of core ideas here. Almost nothing happens that's truly new. You know, almost everything that happens was tried and failed years before. And this whole question of being there without being there, it's something we began studying at the Institute in the 1970s. And there was actually a concept there called travel telecommunication substitution. And of course, it never really worked. And then it evolved into travel telecommunication trade-offs, which was a better way to think about it, but it still never really scaled. And then in 1988, I wrote a book called Groupware. What we're using right now, Zencastr, the medium and the platform and Zoom and Teams, those are things that were prototyped even then. They're groupware. We just don't call it that anymore because that's just what the media are that we use. So as you look ahead, now we're doing a new project on the future of the workplace. And we're looking at full spectrum view of place. And what are the different elements of place? Why do we choose where we work? And it kind of boils down to what are the options for where we could work? Where would we want to work if we had the choice? And from an organization's point of view, where can we be most productive? And this COVID crisis and shutdown and shelter in place, awful as it's been at scale, it's had a certain amount of private or public and positive impact in that it's allowed us to ask the basic question, where do we want to work and where's the most productive places to work? So coming out of that, I think we're going to see a full spectrum of work options. We're going to see a resorting of the nature of the office. And then we're going to see many more hybrid work options. Nobody knows, Art, how this is going to play out and what that spectrum of options are. But we know that it is going to be more of a spectrum than it ever has been, and that it's going to be more hybrid than it ever has been. So in that sense, I think there will be good things coming out of it. But we're just beginning to understand what those are. And the physical office, it's not going to be like going back to the office the way it was. It's going to be going back in ways that are going to be quite different. And as part of this project on the future of workplace, I've seen many of the new designs for the post-COVID office. Most of them are truly depressing. They're physical separation, lots of plastic, lots of wrappers that cover the food. And it's not places you particularly want to go. The new Googleplex, that's the best I've seen so far. Those are really cool, and they've got kind of outside tent structures and some very interesting workplaces. But it's going to be hybrid. I mean, that's the way it's going to play out. And I think ultimately there's going to be less physical office space, reduced amount, because we just don't need it. But if you think of the function, that's going to be what we're going to be challenged on. What's the function of the office?
Well, there are implications for almost every type of activity, from education to, as you mentioned, how we work together in the office to even how we play together.
Yes.
So another interesting concept you introduce in one of your books, again, the one that I'm talking about now is Leadership Literacies, is this notion that leaders have to be emotionally, physically, and mentally healthy, more so than ever before. Why did you come up with that? And why did you, it seems somewhat obvious, right? But why do you emphasize that so much in this book?
Yeah, it's always been necessary for us to be healthy. I mean, that's not new. But in the VUCA world, there's new pressures, and they're round the clock. You know, I worked with a guy at the Institute named Paul Saffo, a brilliant guy. And he said early on about the remote office, you know, happiness is the anytime, any place office, but hell is the every time, every place office. For many people now, we're close to hell. You know, we're getting spread in all these different directions, and we really need to balance it. When I ran the Institute, I had an executive coach, Pierre Mornel, and his advice was more stress, more exercise. In other words, the more stressed you are, the more you should exercise. There's an essence of profound truth there. I think physical exercise is the one thing that everybody agrees on. Mental exercise, we're finally, neuroscience is getting practical, so we're learning a lot more about that. And then spiritual health, it doesn't have to be religious, but we need a sense of meaning. We need a sense of grounding to accept the VUCA world and to engage with the VUCA world in a positive, powerful way. So, you know, that's what I mean by energy, because as a leader, you have to bring energy to the people you're working with, and you have to sustain energy. And we know so much more now about physical health. We learn a lot more about neuro health or brain health and spiritual health. We're reimagining. I've got a chapter in the new book on broader spectrums of meaning. And I refer to work there being done, this group that's a spinoff of Harvard Divinity School, looking at new models of spirituality, new models of meaning. And we do know, and here's another signal, from the latest Blue Zones work, studying the places around the world where people live the longest, healthiest lives, from the latest Blue Zones work, they found that people with a sense of purpose live up to 7 years longer, they're happier, and they're healthier. People who work at purpose-driven organizations live up to 14 years longer. The organizations are higher performing, and the people who work there are happier and they're healthier. So purpose becomes so important, and this links back to giving. If you can come up with a sense of purpose that's consistent with your giving, you'll be happier, you'll be healthier, and you'll live longer.
Well, that's really great to hear you say that. This past Saturday, my wife and I had the first opportunity to attend a party.
Oh, nice.
And we did it without masks, and there were about 25 people there on the rooftop of one of my colleagues' homes.
Wow.
Who was celebrating his 40th birthday.
Wow.
How cool is that, right? And it seems like such a long time ago since we've been able to do that. Now, if I call you a week from now and say, well, Bob, I got COVID, that'd be something. but no, I think we're going to be fine. And the reason I was especially there for this young man's birthday is that he has taken on an idea that I came up with from, you know, some of the work that I'd done through you guys at the Institution for the Future on blockchain. And he has taken this idea and created the first ever blockchain-based donation portal.
Wow.
We call it Give Safely.
Cool.
And it tackles a couple of the things that you've discussed. One of them is security and privacy. Because by using this tool, a person can give their money or they can give cryptocurrency. And it's completely safe because of the blockchain technology. They can give their information to the charity and it's completely safe. But also, a charity can share an experience with this person virtually that they would not be able to do had they not been on this particular platform. And we give away something in return. So there's reciprocity as well. If you give a donation, you get a token that we call wine giving points in return.
Nice.
And so a lot of the elements that you've talked about, we've begun to happily dig our toes into. But sometimes I wonder, Bob, if we're slightly ahead of our time on this, and we're just going to have to persevere until we can get the amount of adoption and scaling, or whether it might turn out to be something that you said before, which is you do something, it becomes a signal, but it fails in an interesting way. I don't think it's going to fail, but maybe it will.
Yeah. Well, you know, future is unpredictable. So we have to engage with that and figure out ways to flip the failures into a better way of doing it next time.
Yeah.
So I'm really optimistic about the future. If we can maintain this sense of hope, which is, you know, hope is clarity. Purpose is the individual version of hope and clarity. And that's what we all need. And what I think we need to do is seek out organizations that have a clarity that attracts us and gives us an opportunity to express our own personal clarity within that envelope of clarity.
Yeah. Well, Bob, I know we're getting to the end of this, but I do want to ask you one additional question about this whole notion of optimism in the face of increasing dilemmas, and how as humans we should think about conducting our affairs to manage through them. I say manage through them because we can't necessarily create the outcomes that we want, but we can manage through them. How do we as humans manage through these, I would say, ongoing crises that seem to be coming up? How do we begin to think about this new normal of change that seems to be hitting us at an increasing pace? How do humans adapt to this?
Yeah, it's definitely a dilemma. So life has always been a VUCA world, beginning from the fact we all have to die. And so there's a sense in which this is nothing new. But what's new is the scale. What's new is the global scale. So now we have climate emergency that's global. We have a rich-poor gap. We've always had a rich-poor gap. It's never been this bad. And it's hard to figure out how to make it better. And we now have these global cybersecurity risks. So there's more of a VUCA world on a global scale than we've ever had. So our challenge is, first of all, to set your expectations. So you need to set your expectation that it's a VUCA world, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, and it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse. So set your expectations for that. Then develop a clarity within that. And I've already shared kind of my overall take that we will face this rolling risk of health and climate disruptions. That's expected. This isn't going to be the last pandemic. And the issue is not just pandemics. It's these global health and climate disruptions that are at the intersection of animal, human health, and land use. We know that's the space. So if you expect that, then the question becomes, how can I engage with that in positive ways? How can I retain my sense of hope? And the way we can do that is to be very clear about direction, very flexible about execution. So keep your clarity, keep your sense of purpose, keep your sense of hope, and then partner with organizations, with nonprofits, with others that you feel like you can invest your money or your energy. Partner in those ways and essentially seek out people with clarity. Avoid people with certainty.
Well, Bob, I want to thank you for joining us on this second and final episode of the Heart of Giving podcast. I commend the first episode to all of our listeners. It was also amazing. And to all of our subscribers, I hope you'll follow us on all major podcast platforms. And thank you for listening. And thank you, Bob.
Thank you. Great to have this conversation.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only, and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.